Chapter 13. Attention to the state of his feelings. But theirs was a successful match, and he had no difficulty in finding his answer. "The best of my feelings are in your keeping, my dear," he said, lightly, and there was so much truth in that obscure phrase that he experienced towards her at the moment a great increase of gratitude and tenderness. Mrs. Gould, however, did not seem to find this answer in the least obscure. She brightened up delicately. Already he had changed his tone. "But there are facts. The worth of the mine as a mine is beyond doubt. It shall make us very wealthy. The mere working of it is a matter of technical knowledge, which I have, which 10,000 other men in the world have. But its safety, its continued existence as an enterprise, giving a return to men, to strangers, comparative strangers who invest money in it, is left altogether in my hands. I have inspired confidence in a man of wealth and position. You seem to think this perfectly natural, do you? Well, I don't know. I don't know why I have, but it is a fact. This fact makes everything possible, because without it, I would never have thought of disregarding my father's wishes. I would never have disposed of the concession as a speculator disposes of a valuable right to a company for cash and shares, to grow rich eventually if possible, but at any rate, to put some money at once in his pocket. No. Even if it had been feasible, which I doubt, I would not have done so. Poor father did not understand. He was afraid I would hang on to the ruinous thing, waiting for just some such chance, and waste my life miserably. That was the true sense of his prohibition, which we have deliberately set aside. They were walking up and down the corridor. Her head just reached to his shoulder. His arm, extended downwards, was about her waist. His spurs jingled slightly. He had not seen me for 10 years. He did not know me. He parted from me for my sake, and he would never let me come back. He was always talking in his letters of leaving Costaguana, of abandoning everything and making his escape. But he was too valuable a prey. They would have thrown him into one of their prisons at the first suspicion. His spurred feet clinked slowly. He was bending over his wife as they walked. The big parrot, turning its head askew, followed their pacing figures with a round, unblinking eye. He was a lonely man. Ever since I was 10 years old, he used to talk to me, as if I had been grown up. When I was in Europe, he wrote to me every month. 10, 12 pages every month of my life for 10 years. And, after all, he did not know me. Just think of it, 10 whole years away, the years I was growing up into a man. He could not know me. Do you think he could? Mrs. Gould shook her head negatively, which was just what her husband had expected from the strength of the argument. But she shook her head negatively, only because she thought that no one could know her Charles, really know him for what he was but herself. The thing was obvious. It could be felt. It required no argument. And poor Mr. Gould, Sr., who had died too soon to ever hear of their engagement, remained too shadowy a figure for her to be credited with knowledge of any sort whatever. No, he did not understand. In my view, this mine could never have been a thing to sell. Never. After all his misery, I simply could not have touched it for money alone, Charles Gould pursued. And she pressed her head to his shoulder approvingly. These two young people remembered the life which had ended wretchedly, just when their own lives had come together in that splendor of hopeful love, which to the most sensible minds appears like a triumph of good over all the evils of the earth. A vague idea of rehabilitation had entered the plan of their life. That it was so vague as to elude the support of argument made it only the stronger. It had presented itself to them at the instant when the woman's instinct of devotion and the man's instinct of activity receive from the strongest of illusions their most powerful impulse. The very prohibition imposed the necessity of success. It was as if they had been morally bound to make good their vigorous view of life against the unnatural error of weariness and despair. If the idea of wealth was present to them, it was only in so far as it was bound with that other success. Mrs. Gould, an orphan from early childhood and without fortune, brought up in an atmosphere of intellectual interests, had never considered the aspects of great wealth. They were too remote, and S.E. had not learned that they were desirable. On the other hand, S.E. had not known anything of absolute want. Even the very poverty of her aunt, the Marchesa, had nothing intolerable to a refined mind. It seemed in accord with a great grief. It had the austerity of a sacrifice offered to a noble ideal. Thus even the most legitimate touch of materialism was wanting in Mrs. Gould's character. The dead man, of whom she thought with tenderness because he was Charlie's father, and with some impatience because he had been weak, must be put completely in the wrong. Nothing else would do to keep their prosperity without a stain on its only real, on its immaterial side. Charles Gould, on his part, had been obliged to keep the idea of wealth well to the fore, but he brought it forward as a means, not as an end. Unless the mine was good business, it could not be touched. He had to insist on that aspect of the enterprise. It was his lever to move men who had capital. And Charles Gould believed in the mine. He knew everything that could be known of it. His faith in the mine was contagious, though it was not served by a great eloquence. But businessmen are frequently as sanguine and imaginative as lovers. They are affected by a personality much oftener than people would suppose, and Charles Gould, in his unshaken assurance, was absolutely convincing. Besides, it was a matter of common knowledge to the men to whom he addressed himself that mining in Costaguana was a game that could be made considerably more than worth the candle. The men of affairs knew that very well. The real difficulty in touching it was elsewhere. Against that there was an implication of calm and implacable resolution in Charles Gould's very voice. Men of affairs venture sometimes on acts that the common judgment of the world would pronounce absurd. They make their decisions on apparently impulsive and human grounds. Very well, had said the considerable personage to whom Charles Gould on his way out through San Francisco had lucidly exposed his point of view. Let us suppose that the mining affairs of Sulaco are taken in hand. There would then be in it. First, the House of Holroyd, which is all right. Then, Mr. Charles Gould, a citizen of Costaguana, who is also all right. And, lastly, the government of the Republic. So far this resembles the first start of the Atacama Nitrate Fields, where there was a financing house, a gentleman of the name of Edwards, and a government, or, rather, two governments, two South American governments. And you know what came of it. War came of it. Devastating and prolonged war came of it, Mr. Gould. However, here we possess the advantage of having only one South American government hanging around for plunder out of the deal. It is an advantage, but then there are degrees of badness, and that government is the Costaguana government. Thus spoke the considerable personage, the millionaire endower of churches on a scale befitting the greatness of his native land, the same to whom the doctors used the language of horrid and veiled menaces. He was a big-limbed, deliberate man, whose quiet burliness lent to an ample silk-faced frock coat a superfine dignity. His hair was iron-gray, his eyebrows were still black, and his massive profile was the profile of a Caesar's head on an old Roman coin. But his parentage was German, and Scotch and English, with remote strains of Danish and French blood, giving him the temperament of a Puritan, and an insatiable imagination of conquest. He was completely unbending to his visitor, because of the warm introduction the visitor had brought from Europe, and because of an irrational liking for earnestness and determination wherever met, to whatever end directed. The Costaguana government shall play its hand for all it's worth, and don't you forget it, Mr. Gould. Now, what is Costaguana? It is the bottomless pit of 10%. Loans and other fool investments. European capital has been flung into it with both hands for years. Not ours, though. We in this country know just about enough to keep indoors when it rains. We can sit and watch. Of course, someday we shall step in. We are bound to. But there's no hurry. Time itself has got to wait on the greatest country in the whole of God's universe. We shall be giving the word for everything. Industry, trade, law, journalism, art, politics, and religion, from Cape Horn clear over to Smith Sound, and beyond to, if anything worth taking hold of turns up at the North Pole. And then we shall have the leisure to take in hand the outlying islands and continents of the earth. We shall run the world's business, whether the world likes it or not. The world can't help it and neither can we, I guess. By this he meant to express his faith in destiny in words suitable to his intelligence, which was unskilled in the presentation of general ideas. His intelligence was nourished on facts, and Charles Gould, whose imagination had been permanently affected by the one great fact of a silver mine, had no objection to this theory of the world's future. If it had seemed distasteful for a moment, it was because the sudden statement of such vast eventualities dwarfed almost to nothingness the actual matter in hand. He and his plans and all the mineral wealth of the Occidental province appeared suddenly robbed of every vestige of magnitude. The sensation was disagreeable, but Charles Gould was not dull. Already he felt that he was producing a favorable impression. The consciousness of that flattering fact helped him to a vague smile, which his big interlocutor took for a smile of discreet and admiring assent. He smiled quietly too, and immediately Charles Gould, with that mental agility mankind will display in defense of a cherished hope, reflected that the very apparent insignificance of his aim would help him to success. His personality and his mind would be taken up, because it was a matter of no great consequence, one way or another, to a man who referred his action to such a prodigious destiny. And Charles Gould was not humiliated by this consideration, because the thing remained as big as ever for him. Nobody else's vast conceptions of destiny could diminish the aspect of his desire for the redemption of the San Tome mine. In comparison to the correctness of his aim, definite in space and absolutely attainable within a limited time, the other man appeared for an instant as a dreamy idealist of no importance. The great man, massive and benignant, had been looking at him thoughtfully. When he broke the short silence, it was to remark that concessions flew about thick in the air of Costaguana. Any simple soul that just yearned to be taken in could bring down a concession at the first shot. Our consuls get their mouths stopped with them, he continued, with a twinkle of genial scorn in his eyes. But in a moment he became grave. A conscientious, upright man, that cares nothing for boodle, and keeps clear of their intrigues, conspiracies, and factions, soon gets his passports. See that, Mr. Gould? Persona non grata. That's the reason our government is never properly informed. On the other hand, Europe must be kept out of this continent, and for proper interference on our part the time is not yet ripe, I dare say. But we here we are not this country's government, neither are we simple souls. Your affair is all right. The main question for us is whether the second partner, and that's you, is the right sort to hold his own against the third and unwelcome partner, which is one or another of the high and mighty robber gangs that run the Costaguana government. What do you think, Mr. Gould, eh? He bent forward to look steadily into the unflinching eyes of Charles Gould, who, remembering the large box full of his father's letters, put the accumulated scorn and bitterness of many years into the tone of his answer. As far as the knowledge of these men, and their methods and their politics is concerned, I can answer for myself. I have been fed on that sort of knowledge since I was a boy. I am not likely to fall into mistakes from excess of optimism. Not likely, eh? That's all right. Tact and a stiff upper lip is what you'll want, and you could bluff a little on the strength of your backing. Not too much, though. We will go with you, as long as the thing runs straight. But we won't be drawn into any large trouble. This is the experiment which I am willing to make. There is some risk, and we will take it. But if you can't keep up your end, We will stand our loss, of course, and then we'll let the thing go. This mine can wait. It has been shut up before, as you know. You must understand that under no circumstances will we consent to throw good money after bad. Thus the great personage had spoken then, in his own private office, in a great city, where other men, very considerable in the eyes of a vain populace, waited with alacrity upon a wave of his hand. And rather more than a year later, during his unexpected appearance in Sulaco, he had emphasized his uncompromising attitude with a freedom of sincerity permitted to his wealth and influence. He did this with the less reserve, perhaps, because the inspection of what had been done, and more still the way in which successive steps had been taken, had impressed him with the conviction that Charles Gould was perfectly capable of keeping up his end. This young fellow, he thought to himself, may yet become a power in the land. This thought flattered him, for hitherto the only account of this young man he could give to his intimates was, my brother-in-law met him in one of these one-horse old German towns, near some mines, and sent him on to me with a letter. He's one of the Costaguana Goulds, pure-bred Englishman, but all born in the country. His uncle went into politics, was the last provincial president of Sulaco, and got shot after a battle. His father was a prominent businessman in Sta. Marta, tried to keep clear of their politics, and died ruined after a lot of revolutions. And that's your Costaguana in a nutshell. Of course, he was too great a man to be questioned as to his motives, even by his intimates. The outside world was at liberty to wonder respectfully at the hidden meaning of his actions. He was so great a man that his lavish patronage of the newer forms of Christianity, which in its naive form of church building amused Mrs. Gould, was looked upon by his fellow citizens as the manifestation of a pious and humble spirit. But in his own circles of the financial world, the taking up of such a thing as the Santome mine was regarded with respect, indeed, but rather as a subject for discreet jocularity. It was a great man's caprice. In the great horrid building, an enormous pile of iron, glass, and blocks of stone at the corner of two streets, cobwebbed aloft by the radiation of telegraph wires, the heads of principal departments exchanged humorous glances, which meant that they were not let into the secrets of the Santome business. The Costaguana mail, it was never large, one fairly heavy envelope, was taken unopened straight into the great man's room, and no instructions dealing with it had ever been issued thence. The office whispered that he answered personally, and not by dictation either, but actually writing in his own hand, with pen and ink, and, it was to be supposed, taking a copy in his own private press copy book, inaccessible to profane eyes. Some scornful young men, insignificant pieces of minor machinery in that 11-story high workshop of great affairs, expressed frankly their private opinion that the great chief had done at last something silly, and was ashamed of his folly. Others, elderly and insignificant, but full of romantic reverence for the business that had devoured their best years, used to mutter darkly and knowingly that this was a portentous sign, that the horrid connection meant by and by to get hold of the whole Republic of Costaguana, lock, stock, and barrel. But, in fact, the hobby theory was the right one. It interested the great man to attend personally to the Santome mine. It interested him so much that he allowed this hobby to give a direction to the first complete holiday he had taken for quite a startling number of years. He was not running a great enterprise there, no mere Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.